The Guardian.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
Welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I meet Australian actor Daniel Henshall to talk about playing one of Australia's most notorious serial killers in the film Snowtown. Director David Weissman will be joining me to discuss We Were Here, his acclaimed documentary about the impact of AIDS in San Francisco. And helping me to review some of the week's other releases is Zan Brooks. We'll be reviewing the latest from Nicolas Cage and the one teenage girls up and down the land have been waiting to get their teeth into, Twilight Breaking Dawn. It's a fantastic podcast. It's Film Weekly. Based on a grisly true story, Snowtown is a dramatisation of the notorious Bodies in Barrels murders, which took place in South Australia between 1992 and 1999. The film, directed by Justin Kurzel, focuses on 16-year-old Jamie, who forms a friendship with his mother's new boyfriend, unaware that John Bunting would go on to become one of Australia's most notorious killers, torturing and murdering 11 people. Daniel Henshall is the young actor who's been winning plaudits for his role as Bunting, so let's hear some of him in action.
G'day, mate.
Good morning, Dave.
I'm John.
How you doing?
You all right?
Pretty good.
Nice to meet you. Take a seat, mate. You hungry? Yeah? I got some bacon and eggs going. Do you want that?
Yeah.
Yeah? All right. Are you hungry again, mate?
Yeah.
You eat like a fucking horse. You do, don't you?
Yeah.
You want some eggs, some bacon and everything?
Yeah.
Sausages? You want a sausage too, Jamie?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. All right. There we go. I'll just get this up and then I'll look after you, all right? Jamie, mate, I'm really sorry if I woke you up last night too, mate. Just had to deal with that fucking prick across the road, eh?
Don't worry about it, Jamie. John will take care of that bit of shit.
Yeah. It's just not right, mate. You know what I mean?
And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Daniel Henshall in the studio here at Film Weekly. Lovely to have you all the way from Australia, Dan.
Thank you.
A notorious man.
Yeah.
And the man you play, I have to say, I didn't know who he was at all. I'd never heard of Snowtown. I'd never heard of John at all. I didn't know what he'd done.
Sure.
So, which actually is fascinating because it gives the film a completely different kind of view
when
if you don't know anything about it at all, when you found out what's going on. Because you don't really know what's going on in the film. That's the joy of it.
Or the
grisly joy of it.
Yeah.
Did you know what was happening? Did you know John was? Did you know what you were getting into?
Back home, there were sensational headlines, you know, Bodies in the Barrels, and that was about it. You know, I was 16 at the time, so I didn't really pay much attention to that more than that. I heard that there was a horrific event, and there was, people dismembered and chopped up and put in barrels with acid and put in a bank vault. That's all I knew, you know. So when the script came along, it was extremely exciting to see that someone was going to try and represent or tell the story again as through relationships rather, not just sensationalise the idea of the horror and do it in a way that you got to try and understand or have a little bit of insight to the community that was affected.
Because this was your first big role, really.
It's my first film at all.
So, I mean, he is Australia's most notorious serial killer.
Yes, so it's pinned. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean...
There's a gallery of rogues that he's competing from the guy that Eric Barner played in Chopper to Ned Kelly, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, no, we do have a few serial killers over the last two or three decades. But I guess the most fascinating thing when you talk about serial killing is that there was four of them in the end, and they killed over a decade. And no one came up and said anything about it. They just let it go on.
So, I mean, presumably he's well-known, this guy, John Bunton. Did you study the real guy, or did you just use the guy that was in Justin Kurzel's script?
Bit of both. He's a very average, normal, seemingly affable guy. Living in the community for 3 months before shooting informed me greatly and us in the film. We met people during the casting process because we cast in the area and met people that had 5 or 6 degrees separation of John Bunting and... You got this wonderful dichotomy, his explanation of, you know, he was normal, he was a great guy, fixed my car, cooked us dinner, looked after my kids, really normal guy. And then people would say, no, I knew, he was a weird guy, he was very strange.
What did you do armed with information thus when you get loose on a performance? Because, I mean, he scared the living daylights. The way that he says mate, or the way that you say mate,
right.
I flinched every time that someone said mate, because you know that is not, I know it's a common Australian word, and that doesn't always mean friend, but... Certainly here. It was like, don't worry, mate. And I was like, oh, no, mate, just means he's going to stab you to death.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was not often do you get a chance to pick up a role like this and play it very indirect. I guess, you know, Justin was very strong on the idea that we wanted to play him with very understated, and not to be insensitive about the subject matter, to the chance to play a character where you get to hide behind the niceties and the affable, likeable, you know, jovial, everyday man was an absolute joy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're right, you know, the everyday things like mate become sickening and terrifying because it's seemingly nice on the outside and then all of a sudden, you know, you find out this guy is a very sick puppy.
Yeah, really. I mean, do you think of great serial killers of the screen past? I mean, when you get a part like that, do you think, I mean, you know, going to play it like big hammy like Hannibal Lecter,
sure,
or low down like John McNaughton's Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer?
Which is a brilliant film.
Yeah. Do you study serial killers and all the great actors that have done it before? It's your first time,
then. I didn't. You know, I think I was locked in to this community for 3 months, like I said before, the shoot, so I was very much immersed in that world, and that was that. There was no borrowing or watching or being inspired by other performers who had done a great job in the past. It was about being in this world, and I think that's what's so authentic about the film, is that we're completely in this world, you know, and having no idea what it's like outside.
Well, true, and for an outsider who wasn't in that world, I had no idea what was going on inside that world as well, which is, to me, that was the joy, as I said, grisly joy.
Right,
it was
the
the rig reveal of the film at the end. I was like, oh, it's true.
Yeah.
I didn't even know it was true.
Yeah, yeah.
And can you imagine not knowing that this was true?
Yeah.
I even thought this film was like, who the hell is going to make a film like this? It's just
right.
Like, this is just disgusting.
People do find it offensive, and then they know, they understand, they get the cards at the end saying, you know, based on a true story, so-and-so is now in prison, so-and-so has done this. And
I was like, oh, well, that's all right then.
Yeah.
Anyway, it kind of, you know what I mean? It melted away from kind of sheer grisliness to a kind of awful kind of, how can this happen? Because, you know, it was a community that basically was disenfranchised. People fell through the cracks in a way. People went missing and no one knew.
Yeah, well, it's a forgotten people, that's for sure. I think there's many communities like that across the country that you just forget about, that don't have a voice, that don't have a representation in the greater community, and it's very easy to throw stones at them and put them in a place and say, oh, that's that demographic, that's who they are, and just leave them down there. And being a part of that community was an eye-opening experience.
Yeah.
I found it very welcoming, to be honest. Most people give you the time of day after 5 minutes.
Did they know you were going to be playing John Munting?
They did. We were very honest. We were very upfront and very honest. I mean, because we cast from the area, so we hit the streets and met people and, you know, said who we were, and most people...
Because you're about the only professional actor, weren't you?
There's three of us, but yeah, right. As far as one of the leads, the only one in the leads.
I was amazed by Elizabeth, the woman who plays Elizabeth. I thought she was a seasoned professional.
Yeah,
she'd been doing it for years.
Louise Harris is just an revelation.
She's housewife in the area?
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, she's got
extraordinary. I thought
single
she was
mother.
I thought, oh, this is, you know, like Jackie Weaver in Animal Kingdom,
right,
got her Oscar, you know, and she was like, oh, brought back from the new wave of the 70s. I thought it was another one that they discovered.
No, she's that's the first timer.
What a performance.
Yeah, I know, tell me about it. She's just brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
I mean, now I mention Animal Kingdom, it's interesting because we've got two, I think, really superb Aussie crime dramas of the last years that are deeply kind of nasty, they're kind of uneasy, they kind of wheeze like broken beasts. It seems to me that there are these two kind of really fine crime dramas that represent almost a new... I always hesitate to say that Australian cinema's back and it's a new wave and that the Peter Weir generation are coming back.
Well, I think internationally it's back. I mean, we, the last five years we've produced some really great films and have had international success critically, and I think Animal Kingdom has brought back not just a critical acclaim but a public acclaim. And it's interesting because a lot of people have asked me, you know, oh, you know, you guys do crime so well. I go, well, we do, but there are other films that are coming out that you haven't seen yet. That it seems to be a renaissance in Australian film, which is great to be a part of, especially, you know, being my age and coming into it. You know,
yeah, you do crime well though.
We do.
Crime.
Yeah,
there is an interesting look at crime. I think it's because we think of it as all sunny and Bondi Beach and kind of maybe a bit of a shark every now and then.
Right.
My God, those sharks are inland now.
I think, and also British cinema, you know, there is something very similar in the way we tell our violence. The story, you know, I mean, you know, not that makes much sense, but I think that British cinema is very similar in its explanation of domesticity and the banality of violence that comes through the kitchen sink drama. And I think the way we portray it's very similar. So the Brits seem to latch on to that, which is a great thing, because back home we're the same. We love British cinema.
Yeah. Well, we kind of gave you that. We gave you our crime. You know, that's what I mean. So we're getting it back now, and I thank you very much. Daniel Henschel, thank you very much for
coming.
You're
very back. Welcome.
A superb performance. You're much
nicer
than a serial killer that you play. I'm really...
It's all smoke and mirrors.
But I don't trust you. That's the thing. I still don't trust you. You're an actor, and that's that.
Yeah.
Brilliant performance, brilliant film.
Thank
so
you, mate.
Thank you.
Cheers,
so much.
Thank you.
Snowtown is released on Friday the 18th of November, and we welcome someone equally disturbing who walks in with a shovel. It's Zam Brooks, The Guardian's very own critic at large. This week we'll look at Snowtown, Zam. We'll also look at Justice, which stars Nicolas Cage and Guy Pearce. The latest in the never-ending Twilight saga, Breaking Dawn, is upon us, and we'll go on a magic trip as well, Zam, together. But first, Snowtown. Daniel Henshall shuffles out, you shuffle in.
Yeah.
He played the brooding John Bunting. I didn't know this story at all until I saw, and I know the film was a hit at sort of Cannes, and then it was at the London Film Festival, the part up for the Southern and all. I'd managed to sort of remain impervious to it. I didn't know what it was about, and I watched it, and I didn't know what it was about until the end.
No, me neither. It's you know, obviously it was a very famous or infamous story in Australia in 1999, the bodies in the barrel murder, but for some reason this completely passed us by, which I think helps the film.
Yeah.
Because
have we spoiled it now for everyone, telling them what it's about?
Well, not really. No. I mean, you don't know how it gets there.
No,
but and there's certainly, it's a film that's full of menace pretty much right from the off.
Yeah.
You know, you're mentioning Animal Kingdom there. There's that great sense of the Australian suburbs as this weirdly fertile breeding ground for evil,
yeah.
I guess,
yeah.
And certainly for dysfunctional families, and people just kind of rattling around. And there's no real centre to these places. It's just, you know, the road and the bungalows on either side. And within that kind of cauldron, you get this sort of terrible simmering sense of terror.
Yeah, I mean, it's a worrying film to me.
It's a terrifying film.
I sort of enjoyed it at the end.
I'm glad I saw it. But it's, my God, it's queasy, and it's got, you know, the scene in the bath is you watch through your splayed
fingers. I really
fingers.
Did. I was like, that's how I like to talk to you, Zan, just in case it all,
just in
all
case
sparks
it kicks
off. Yeah.
There's a lot of resentment building between us, Jason. And one day,
it's all
some scores will be settled.
Now, I often think that about Nicolas Cage, that he is a man who could do anything on screen. Invariably these days, it's probably rubbish, but
yep.
Occasionally he'll hit a high point. Well, not so long ago, he was in New Orleans for Werner Herzog for The Bad Lieutenant.
Which was great.
Excellent. Port of Orleans, Bad Lieutenant. He is back in New Orleans for a new film called Justice. It co-stars Guy Pearce and January Jones off of Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
And here they are.
You know who did this?
Yeah, he's done it before. He'll do it again. If you want, we can take care of him for you.
Take care of him? What do you mean? Arrest him?
Well, if we hand him over to the police, it'll take at least 6 months for DNA tests to be completed. Ultimately, there'd be a trial, but your wife, assuming she didn't drop the charges, would be dragged through this nightmare over and over. She'd be in court, she'd be questioned by lawyers. And even if the DA gets a conviction, which is not guaranteed, a rapist can serve as little as 11 months, you know, which is half the time you get for tax evasion.
Who are you?
I'm Simon. I represent an organization that that deals with people like the man who raped your wife, and we would very much like to take care of him for you.
Now, there was a Nicolas Cage movie out last week called Trespass with Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
That wasn't very good.
That wasn't very good.
And what's Justice? Is this a brilliant Nicolas Cage movie?
Well, Justice could almost be the sequel to Trespass, isn't it? First the Trespass, then the Justice. The difference here is that whereas in Trespass he was wearing glasses, which showed that he was a sensitive man, here he's got a little goatee, which shows that he's a sensitive man. And beyond that, you could almost kind of just flip these films around. I don't know what the hell he's doing.
What is going on here?
Well, basically, him and January Jones are happily married. Then she is assaulted on the street. And as is the way of things in the country going to hell in a handcart, we just know that the evildoer who's done this is going to get off scot-free. But then a mysterious man played by Guy Pearce arrives and says, we can sort this problem for you. You don't have to pay anything, but we may call on you for a favour at some stage in the future.
So he's done a deal with the shaven-headed devil.
He's done a deal with the sharp-suited devil, yeah.
And is now in hock to a vigilante group. We don't quite know.
We don't quite know. Guy Pearce represents, he says, I represent an organisation that loves this city and wants to kind of clean it up.
Yeah.
But of course, you know that he's going to come back to collect. And then, you know, sure enough, Nick Cage finds himself chased by the cops, wanted for a crime, running around freeways and jumping off bridges.
Isn't he? He's just an ordinary man. He's a school teacher.
He's an ordinary man.
He's a school teacher who teaches Shakespeare rather badly.
Yeah, he's an ordinary man in an extraordinary situation. Again.
Again. But he gets more and more useless at running. I noticed that his running is terrible. Yeah. Screen running is difficult at the best of times. Justin Timberlake, actually, in Time, sci-fi film the other week.
Yeah.
He ran. Film.
I wonder they didn't bump into each other on the freeway.
Yes. You can't go down here. I'm afraid Nicolas Cage is coming the other way. But then he jumps over it and he can fall down and he can jumps. Outrun goons who you'd have thought are trained for this.
He can outrun goons, doesn't he? But isn't that the amazing thing about the ordinary man in an extraordinary situation? That maybe he finds out that he's a little bit extraordinary.
Yeah.
He's up to the task.
That is cinema.
That is the message that Nick Cage has with this film. And the other message, I think, is that vigilantism maybe isn't all it's cracked up to be.
They don't really make this sort of thing anymore, a kind of, you know, action-y man, except with, you know,
Nicolas Cage.
Last week. it seemed to me very emblematic of the way that Hollywood has got lost. It can't be asked to make these films because no one wants to go see it. So it gets kind of old hands like Roger Donaldson to direct them. And they're very half-hearted. They're kind of very sort of low-budgety but glossy. And they're really rubbish.
Yeah, that's interesting. You could almost do a thing that these are the Westerns of the 1960s, aren't they? When the Western was dying out.
Yeah.
These are the equivalent now.
Yeah.
And you've got Nick Cage, who obviously is, you know, probably making 20, 40 million a year, but is still seen as an actor who's slightly on the slide. And this is where he's increasingly fetching up. And this is, for what it's worth, this is entirely diverting.
Yeah,
for
that's the thing.
I mean, the
we've
first
been trashed
half.
It, but it's sort of like, well, it's kind of, I would have quite liked this stuff 20 years ago.
I guess so, yeah. But after that, it gets a little bit samey and boring, and there's way too much running on the freeway.
Yeah, there's an element that it's heart to heart in some kind of way, that there's kind of like a chase scene, but it's never that frightening.
No, it's never really that frightening.
You might as well use golf buggies. It won't be long. That's Justice with Nicolas Cage and Guy Pearce. Now, Zan, I know you've been waiting for this moment. I know that you've been kind of hankering. You've got a bloodlust for the Twilight genre.
Yep.
The fourth in the series is here. Twilight Saga continues with Breaking Dawn.
I, Edward Cullen, take you, Bella Swan.
For better or for worse.
To love.
To cherish. As long as we both shall live.
Oh, I'm in the mood. I'm in the mood for getting married to Kristen Stewart. That's what he does here. What's his name? R-Pats.
R-Pats. It could have been you.
It could have been me.
Yeah, could still be you.
I've always quite like Kristen Stewart, I have to say. I always thought she was the kind of reason
She's
to watch these
good,
series.
Yeah.
She was good.
But, oh, yeah, yeah.
Is this the worst?
This is the worst, isn't it?
I mean, by quite a long
Good margin. I remember having a kind of sneaking affection for the first movie when it came out, because you kind of think there's a place for stories about mopey, self-absorbed teenagers, because I guess a lot of teenagers are mopey and self-absorbed.
You were one.
I was one, and I only grew out of it a couple of years ago. But I wish that this would grow out of
it. Well, you're getting married now. Come on, you're getting how long can you be mopey and still listen to that music for? You change. I remember changing taste in music a lot as a teenager.
Yeah,
And they don't.
Well, I guess that's the thing, that the teenage moment is a moment. It's ephemeral. And this is just wallowing on and on and on. And just the hilarious thing about the title, Breaking Dawn Part 1, isn't the whole thing about Breaking Dawn is that it breaks and then it's dawn and then it's day.
Final Destination, Part 5.
Yeah, Never Ending Story, Part 3. But yeah, this is now going to be split into two.
I got that kind of dread, Harry Potter did it with the last one.
Yeah.
And you think that first part one of the end of the Harry Potter,
that was
just
terrible.
Nothing happened.
No.
And in fact, it reminded me a bit of Twilight. They just moped around in the woods for a bit. I liked her. Here is she's getting married to Robert Pattinson, the vampire.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole kind of wedding scene that goes on for
hours. A wedding scene, and then you've got what's his name? Jacob the Wolf Boy.
Taylor Lautner,
who gets so angry at the wedding that he tears off his shirt.
Yes. He actually tears it off in the first 5 seconds.
He does,
For those who need to know. He gets a wedding invitation, gets very angry, tears his top off, runs and becomes a werewolf, goes away, comes back. It's a wedding scene that sort of is so bored with its own clichédness that it can't be bothered to do the wedding scene bits.
No, you've got the sort of speeches, haven't you?
Yeah.
You've got a kind of weird montage of speeches. And then from there, they, you know, as is the way with weddings, they move on to the honeymoon, which looks wonderful. It's out in Brazil somewhere.
Yeah.
And then from there, onto the pregnancy. But this, you know, and this is obviously the way that it should go in a sort of, you know, healthy American Mormon kind of environment. And yet there's a problem because obviously the baby's half vampire.
Yeah, you see. Is it a spoiler to say that she gets pregnant with that? I mean, everyone seems to know that.
I'm pretty sure that's in the trailer, isn't it?
Well, I saw that there was the wedding. What I couldn't get was, do her parents know that she's marrying a vampire?
No, they
and if not, why are all these mates got red eyes? Are they just a bunch of stoners or something? Or are these parents completely stupid?
There's a lot about this that is not explained. And the weird thing is, it doesn't seem to be explained because people just don't care.
I think you're right.
That they just think, people are going to come see this anyway. There's this absolute cynicism that permeates every frame of this film in a way that weirdly wasn't there in the first, yeah, in the first film. Here it is, just that we can do anything. And that may be liberating, but in this, it's just this terrible, stultifying, just tick the box, have a scene in the wedding, have a scene, yeah, in the honeymoon.
And here's another track. I mean, yeah, every single cut was greeted by another tuneless kind of moaning, and I, yeah, don't even know the bands anymore. Now, surely they would have changed. They should have changed since the first one, because pop is ephemeral as well, but they seem to be the same people moaning about the same stuff. I couldn't believe it. It was a music video. It had all the narrative depth of one as well.
Because it did, yeah. Just
every scene had no... And I turned to people next to me who I've seen all bloody three Twilights before. Mm. I can't really remember what's happening because it's not the most important thing in my life. But the people who said they were fans, I said, so why can that happen?
Yeah,
there's,
yeah,
no logic in, yeah, anymore to them. They seem to have given up their own internal world.
I think they have. And again...
And this is crucial for the climax of this film as well, which involves the werewolf and, mm, the baby. And I was like, well, he's done this, says Robert Pattinson in that kind of expository.
Yeah, he does. Dialogue. He has a big expository.
And I was like, but how can you do that? You can't just say that's just happened. Oh, it's done this. you gave me no clue that could happen. So dramatically, I just can't be involved.
The magic is gone. The spell is broken. It's sad that this is directed by Bill Condon.
Yeah, who did Gods and Monsters.
Who did Gods and Monsters and Kinsey, which,
yeah,
I thought was very good,
very
as well.
Interesting films.
So they've got this weird habit of getting respected directors to helm these utterly flaccid, pointless movies that drags the director's reputation down with them.
Yeah, and he must have thought, oh, I can do something because of Gods and Monsters. I deal with freaks, yeah, and I deal with people interested in sexual psyche.
Anguish.
So Kinsey,
yeah,
and Gods and Monsters.
Yeah,
this
absolutely
could be great.
This is tailor-made.
But no, Taylor Lautner.
Taylor Lautner.
that is Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn, of which there'll be more. I think. Is there only one more? Is that a promise?
That is a promise. That's my promise to you.
Thanks, Dan. That's really kind of you. Zan, also out this week is Magic Trip, which details the Ken Casey acid-fueled journey from San Francisco across America that was first chronicled in Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Here's 40 years, this home movie of that trip has lain dormant, and Alex Gibney, the Oscar-winning documentary maker, and his editor have unearthed it to make this of it.
We weren't old enough to be beatniks, and we were a little too old to be hippies. Everybody I knew had read On the Road.
It stirred us up.
So we decided to go travel across the country.
Since it turned out that there were so many of us, we decided we'd buy a bus.
It was like a troop of minstrels.
There was this guy with no shirt on, talking a mile a minute.
Cassidy is going to drive the bus.
It looked like a traveling pleasure palace. It was big and roomy and spacious, until we got all the people in it.
What fun. Are you on acid, Zan?
I felt like I was on acid during Twilight, but yes, but not so much during this, fortunately.
I mean, it's a lot of people who are on acid are in this film, on Magic Trip. Now, I have heard that, you know, taking acid kind of leaves you, you know, kind of happy for a bit and then maybe, you know, stuck for a long time with the
after
effects. Yeah,
well, you read about it quite a lot in your student years.
Exactly. So this is exactly what this film was like. I thought, oh, that's quite funny, they're on acid. And then, oh, they're still on acid. And now they've gone and sat in the water and they're not moving. And it was incredibly boring watching these people. No wonder this film could not get made before, because it was rubbish.
But isn't that the cliche about drugs? It's great when you're on them, but watching other people on drugs is just one of the worst experiences
ever. So I thought it was sort of an advert for kind of not ever taking drugs, ever.
Most films seem to be that, though, yeah, whether they're trying to be or not. You know, it's November. I did look at it and think, I'd quite like to be off driving around America, but not with these
not
people.
Not with these people, thank you very much. Stay with your family, Dan. Be very like, that'll be more like Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah, it'll be like one of those Chevy Chase national vacation
lampoons things. Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed. For more of Zan and the best collection of film writings, videos and podcasts, go to guardian.co.uk/film. We We Were Here is a remarkable new documentary about the coming of what was called the gay plague in the early 1980s. Director David Weissman looks at the impact of the epidemic of AIDS on the gay community in San Francisco, and instead of dwelling on the thousands of deaths, he focuses on five people who survived and share their reminiscences of the plague years.
People were coming in with pneumocystis, pneumonia, who were quite well, you know, one day, you know, out there swimming, playing tennis, you know, buffed, coming in and were dying. I mean, we're dead 10 days later. People would come in with Kaposi sarcoma. There might be one little lesion or two little lesions, and they would grow. And maybe a lesion would cut off circulation in their leg, and their leg would balloon up. Or maybe it would get into their lung, and they couldn't breathe. And maybe they would just waste away.
And I'm thrilled to say that David Weissman, the maker of We Were Here, joins me in the Film Weekly studio. Welcome, David. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
You are here, in fact, now.
I am here. Nice to be here.
But you were there, and it is a testament to people, I suppose, who lived through the AIDS epidemic, the gay plague in San Francisco. It's a story of survival as much as what happened.
It is. I mean, I knew from the very beginning that that's what I wanted, is I wanted people who came to San Francisco because of what the city represented prior to the AIDS epidemic. I think all through the 50s and 60s and 70s, it was a beacon for people who were seeking freedom, who were looking for life in spite of opportunity. They were looking for a place where they could be themselves. And so the city already had a kind of an atmosphere of creativity and political activism and just a kind of a community spirit.
Were you one of those people yourself?
I moved there in 76. Yeah, I had long hair, and I was one of the gay hippies in San Francisco in the late 70s, and it was a really beautiful time to be there.
Why there? I mean, are you from there?
I grew up in Los Angeles, but, you know, even as a kid, as an 11, 12-year-old, I knew about the Haight-Ashbury district and the hippies, and the city always represented something special to me.
Yeah, it's lovely. I've been there myself. Yeah. It feels, because it's cooler, you know what I mean? Actually, in the weather, you know, I think you hit there, it's got its own climate. It's kind of, you know, it feels a bit freer. The wind is fresher.
It is, and it's this beautiful peninsula of hills on the end of the United States, and people who need to escape from the constrictions of normal life always managed to find their way to San Francisco. And so it's always had a wonderful collection of free spirits.
Mm. Particularly the flourishing of the Castro. Your film captures that beginning, the people that were there when Castro kind of suddenly grew into, I suppose, the most famous gay street in the world.
It was really the first like community of openly gay, self-proclaimed gay people in the history of the world. I mean, it was different from Berlin in the 20s, and it was different from Greenwich Village, because it was really open in a different way. And so it was this tremendous social experiment and very exuberant. Mm.
And people seem to have documented it very well. I mean, the reason your film works for me is because it has a fantastic array of photographs. You know, people, a lot of moustaches. I think your film might win an award for the most moustaches included in any film. So for that alone, the golden moustache is yours. But the self-documentation is crucial to this, because the pictures, which are in very good quality, are very revealing of the time and the history.
Well, one of the things as filmmakers that we did that was a little unusual was to opt for more still images than moving images in that period. And for me, that was partially because I really wanted to look into the eyes of the people who were there. And there's a lot of images of people looking directly at the camera, and it's really about making an intimate personal connection.
Where did you get all those images?
A lot of the images came from the Gay and Lesbian Historical Society in San Francisco. There was a number of photographers who died of AIDS who were very prominent and did beautiful work and who left their collections to the Historical Society. So it was a tremendous resource.
For you shooting these people, as you told us, you were there since 1976. You must have known many of these people for a long time. Was it difficult for you to get them in front of the camera? Is this, in a sense, a story you've wanted to tell for a long time, and only now, 30 years, really, has the distance seemed enough?
It never really occurred to me as a filmmaker to make a movie about this. I mean, it would have seemed like such a daunting subject matter to re-immerse myself in, just because it was such a painful part of my past. And also, I think that I would have worried that the movie would only be depressing, which ultimately it is not. I think ultimately it's a very uplifting movie about
the
power of community.
Well, that's why I called it a survivor's movie. In a way, if you just see a Holocaust movie and it's just about the kind of horror of the camps, then it would be depressing. But it's actually the fact that they didn't kill you.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that makes the movie really work the way that it does is that you fall in love with the five people who are being interviewed very, very quickly. And you know that no matter what the story is, that you're going to see over the next hour and a half, that all of these people will still be there at the end. So you know, you already have that sense of safety and redemption in knowing that these people who you're meeting and you're hearing their stories made it through, and made it through with shining colors, because they're very inspiring people.
That said, when you say you never thought about making a film of it, now watching your documentary, which I appreciate it, and I mean this complimentary, it's a straight up documentary. It's a talking heads. It uses still photography. It uses archive. It's well researched, but using talking head narrative. It doesn't go tricky. It doesn't kind of go off into kind of unreliable narration and all of that. But as I was watching it, I was thinking, wow, this could make an amazing kind of disaster movie, if you see what I mean. The first discovery of the KS, the first sarcomas that come up, and everyone suddenly bursting out. It has that narrative. It makes me think, why hasn't it been a kind of big blockbuster narrative? I was like, oh my God, all the gay people are dying.
You know, I think even for those of us who lived through it, looking back at it from this vantage point, it is really shocking that it actually happened. Mm. I mean, when you're in the middle of it, you sort of have to normalize it, because there's no other way to get through it except by saying, well, this is life now. This is the life that we're living. But for me, and I think for almost everybody I've talked to of my generation who's seen the movie, there's this a validation that it actually was real. And looking back and thinking, how the hell did we manage to get through all of this? And I think that there's a piece of that that is claiming that we learned a lot with all of our wounds that we're carrying and all of the damage and all of the hurt and sorrow. There's a tremendous beauty of coming out of the end of the worst of those years. Certainly the epidemic is still going on, but I think that it is an extraordinary thing. And I think that it's a story that really could not have been told sooner. I think with a kind of a historical tragedy of this magnitude, enough time needs to pass where people can take a breath, go on with their lives, and then be able to see it from the perspective of time and distance.
And the survivors, yourself and the guys that are in your film, who are all very eloquent. I love the flower seller, by the way. Is he still selling flowers?
He's still selling flowers. Guy is always out there with a second chair at his flower stand. It's an invitation for anyone to come by, and he's always there entertaining folks.
Really? He's brilliant. I'm going to go and see him. Have you got any idea why they survived and why others didn't?
Well, some people didn't get infected. I mean, I'm HIV negative after all of this, and I moved to San Francisco, you know, in the years before we knew it was happening. And some people, I think, survived by probably a matter of having some different variation of the virus or having a different genetic capacity to resist it. You know, they managed their medications over the years enough to be able to make it through. I don't think there's any answer, and I think that the question of why did I survive is one that plagues people. I mean, it's called survivor's guilt, and
some people
feel it. Yeah. Well,
but you're Jewish as well, so you have a
well,
a double.
I'm Jewish. I have Holocaust experience in my background, and I think that in my family, and I think that colored the way I experienced the epidemic already. I think that during those years, I was aware of my grandparents' generation and how long it took them to be able to speak about their experiences, and I think that I knew because of that at some point, we who were living through AIDS, we who would survive, would probably need to go through our own process of healing and telling our stories for subsequent generations.
We were here, that for you?
It is in many ways, yeah. I mean, we were here as an affirmation of those of us who took a stand and who lived through it. It's also an affirmation of the dead. And it's an affirmation of place, of just the specificity of San Francisco.
And it's an absolutely beautiful testament to all of that. David Weissman, thank you so much for coming on Film With Me.
Thank you very much.
And We Were Here is on limited release in the UK from Friday the 25th of November. Don't forget, The Observer on Sunday has the best film news and reviews, and of course, my column, Trailer Trash. The music we've been featuring on the show this week is the soundtrack to Twilight Breaking Dawn. Just to put you in a good mood, it's by Carter Burwell, would you believe? But until next week, when my guest will be Terence Davis, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly this week, Simon Barnard, have a great week at the cinema. Bye.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243, PBS. Where television matters.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.